I'd kind of like to know who was in charge of bringing the potato salad this morning, and whether you made it with mayonnaise or mustard. It looks to me like this is more like a family reunion with old friends and family than a lecture. And if y'all would rather, we can just go straight to the eat and have some coffee. Good morning. The title of this session and the follow-up this afternoon at 3 is Desperately Wanting to Believe Again, Part 1 and 2. Or as I might ask the question, is it okay to have doubt? So here we go. Is it okay to have doubt? Is it okay to have doubt? Boy, I sure hope so. My name is Les Ferguson, Jr., and I struggle with doubt. I struggle with doubt, and it absolutely scares me to death. I doubt. Almost 3 years ago, in an effort to deal with my anger and frustration and doubt, I started writing a blog that I called Desperately Wanting to Believe Again. And since then, a number of folks have asked me from time to time, just what was it that I was desperately wanting to believe? And that's a valid question. And I want you to know that I believe. I believe in God the Father. I believe in the Holy Spirit. I believe in Jesus and His sacrificial death on behalf of sinners everywhere. I believe in the goodness of God. In spite of all our difficulties, the horror of tragedy, the double murder that ripped our lives, our family asunder, I still believe in the goodness, love, and mercy of God. But there are days in which that belief does little to stem the tide of doubt that sometimes raises its ugly head and assails me. Somebody once suggested to me, and in the middle of my anger, in the middle of my pain, somebody once suggested to me that I needed to just stop and realize and deal with the fact that God did not stop the crucifixion of Jesus. And the point they were trying to make, and the point they were trying to get me to see, was that if God could give up His Son, if God wouldn't stop the death of His Son, there was no reason to stop the death of mine. But there's a real huge difference between me and Jesus. I know you may not be able to see it, but there's a real huge difference between me and the Son of God. There's a real big difference between me and God. The death of Jesus and His resurrection was a foregone conclusion. That was the plan that God enacted to redeem broken, sinful man by the greatest of all sacrifices. And I'm thankful for that. I want you to know I believe in the resurrection of the dead. I believe that even now, my deceased son and my deceased wife, the mother of my children, I believe that even now, they know perfection firsthand, up close, and personal. And I rejoice, even as my heart stays broken at the destruction of my family. Still, I doubt. My doubt is not just about my family or anybody else other than me, at least directly. What I want to believe and know, again, with all of my heart, with all of my soul, what I want to know and believe again is God's love and God's protection toward me, that God is looking at me as one of His children, and He has my best interests at heart. That's my struggle. There are still days of raw grief in which every fiber of my being fights an ongoing battle that just screams, God failed me, or turned His back, or at least took some kind of long, extended vacation. Where was He? And I'm not alone. Not hardly. Now, there are folks every day who feel and know these thoughts and who express these words just countless times in countless numbers by people who wonder and question, who agonize over why their lives have to be full of such pain and sorrow. And like me, they want to know. They want to believe, and they're searching for the faith and the hope and the trust that they want to put in the hands of God. And those people who are like that, those people who are like me, those people who are me, we still believe. We just have a few more doubts to wrestle with than others. One of my favorite passages in all the Bible talks about the earth groaning in anticipation of being renewed. And I'm reading from Romans chapter 8 out of the Holman Christian Standard Bible. But Paul writes, "For all creation is waiting eagerly for that future day when God will reveal who His children really are. Against its will, all creation was subjected to God's curse. But with eager hope, the creation looks forward to the day when it will join God's children in glorious freedom from death and decay. For we know that all creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to this present time." I love this promise of renewal. I crave the reality of rebirth, being remade all over again without the flaws I currently have. I can't wait until we all experience our full and realized potential. But Scripture says nature groans with the hurt, the weight, and the wail of becoming what creation was always intended to be. That includes me, and that includes you. Our spirits groan in harmony with all creation to experience what God designed us for. But I wonder if you hear the doubt inherent there. I wonder if you can feel somehow the doubt. This passage is about what I call doubt on a universal level. This passage is about that future day when all questions, when all answers will be given, when everything will be made remade new, when all will be made right, when all that pain will be gone, when all future suffering won't exist anymore, no potential for it, when everything will be as God intended. If you're like me, you're saying, "How long, O Lord, how long? When will you come again? When will you end this doubt and this misery and this pain and this hurt?" So in the meantime, I doubt. In the here and the now, some days worse than others, I doubt. I wrestle. I struggle with my value and my worth in the eyes of God. I've learned to love King David. His words are mine. "As the deer longs for streams of water, so I long for you, O God. I thirst for God, the living God. When can I go and stand before Him? Day and night, I have only tears for food, while my enemies continually taunt me, saying, 'Where is this God of yours?' My heart is breaking as I remember how it used to be. I walked among the crowds of worshipers, leading a great procession to the house of God, singing for joy and giving thanks amid the sound of a great celebration. And then, 'O God, my rock,' I cry, 'Why have you forgotten me? Why must I wander around in grief, oppressed by my enemies? Their taunts break my bones. They scoff. Where is this God of yours?'" This is about doubt. This is about doubt. Doubt's one of those things that you don't plan for. It's one of those things that you don't plan on. We don't schedule it on our agendas. I never once went to bed at night and thought to myself, "Self, tomorrow you are going to have a major attack of doubt." I never answered an alarm on my phone to see that I had somehow in the past scheduled and put on my calendar a period of doubt. I never once went to lunch. Never once went to lunch and while eating my nachos made the decision to suddenly have a major outbreak of doubt. I never once went to lunch and said, "You know what, today'd be a good day to question God and wonder where He is and why he's not doing what I think he ought to do. Maybe today would be a good day for me to just question his motives and shake my finger at him a little bit and stomp around and demand him to answer things that I want answered. Doubt's kind of like the things that trigger grief. It does not come with a time or a schedule. Doesn't happen that way. Anybody here ever dealt with intense, severe, deep grief? Oh, you can get up in a day and be perfectly fine. And if you're like me, you walk out of the bathroom and you happen to look down and your eyes catch the picture of your son's graduation that you avoid on any other day, and for whatever reason your eyes catch it and you're done. Time to get back in the shower and cry a little while when nobody can see you and know what's going on. Doubt doesn't come with a time or a schedule. It makes its appearance when you least expect it. It's not planned. It's not wanted. It's not thought out. In the 3 p.m. session today, we're going to talk a little bit, hope to share a little bit of information on how you can prepare yourself for those times when doubt appears. But for now, we need to just ask the question, is it okay to have doubt? And the answer, are you ready for this? The answer is yes. Doubt is allowed because it is a part of the human condition. It is a part of nature. It's inherent in the fiber of creation. But more than that, doubt is allowed because it is irrevocably tied to faith. One of y'all got a quarter I can borrow? Not you, Jan. You got to dig through that big purse. It'll take you forever. Somebody got it. Anybody got a coin? Take a coin. If you got a coin, take it out of your pocket. Here, I'm going to hold yours.
Want it back, though.
No. You owe me more than that. But if you've got a coin in your pocket, I want you to look at it. You know, just get a little bit of the tactile sensation of holding it so you can get what I'm trying to say. I want you to look at that coin. If you take it out and you look at it, it's got two sides, right? Start a football game, what do? With it? You flip it. If it lands on heads, you win. If it lands on tails, you lose, or whatever you call. It's got two sides. One we call heads, one we call tails. Instead of monetary value, I want you to consider that coin. I want you to consider that coin as being representative of God, at least in our relationship with Him. I don't want you to see that coin as God. They'll be running me out of here for heresy, saying God is money. But I want you to see it as being representative of your relationship with God. And instead of heads or tails, I want you to see the two sides. One is being faith, and the other side as being doubt. Doubt is the other side of the coin. You can't have one without the other. They are irrevocably intertwined. The Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, he says, faith is the confidence that what we hope for will actually happen. It gives us assurance about things we cannot see. If we could see it, it wouldn't be what? It wouldn't be faith. If we could see it, we wouldn't have to choose whether we're going to believe or trust. Please understand, as I said before, I believe in God. I believe the evidence is there for me to know. Creation tells me that there is something much bigger than I. Can a guy get an amen there? I believe in God. But on the other hand, if you want the brutal truth, on the other hand, a difficult, a harsh bloodbath experience has taught me that there are circumstances and situations that make it hard to trust, even harder to understand. Times like that, you may not have any answers, or worse, you may not even know what questions to ask. And when that happens, say hello to doubt. Doubt takes many different shapes. Some people doubt the validity of the Bible. Others may doubt the existence of God. And still others may believe in God and His written word, but through their own experiences, through their own pain, their doubt is more about a God who truly cares for them. Again, I love these words of David. He says, save me, O God, for the floodwaters are up to my neck. Deeper and deeper I sink into the mire. I can't find a foothold. I'm in deep water, and the floods overwhelm me. I'm exhausted from crying for help. My throat is parched. My eyes are swollen with weeping, waiting for my God to help me. I could have written those words. I could have written them. And then, oh Lord, how long will you forget me? Forever? How long will you look the other way? How long must I struggle with anguish in my soul, with sorrow in my heart every day? How long will my enemy have the upper hand? Turn and answer me, O Lord, my God. Restore the sparkle to my eyes, or I will die. Don't let my enemies gloat, saying, we have defeated him. Don't let them rejoice at my downfall. Or how about Habakkuk? How long, O Lord, must I confess? How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Violence is everywhere. I cry, but you do not come to save. Must I forever see these evil deeds? Why must I watch all this misery? Wherever I look, I see destruction and violence. I am surrounded by people who love to argue and fight. The law has become paralyzed, and there is no justice in the courts. The wicked far outnumber the righteous, so that justice has become perverted. Can I confess? I am that guy. I doubt. Doubt is exhausting. Waiting on God is excruciating. I am weary with the constant refrain, how long, O Lord, how long? Even now, is it hot in here? Just me working up the sweat. Oh yeah, forgot about that. Thank you. I know you do. Some of the church that I preached at several years ago, when all this bad stuff happened, is here on the front row, and they've forgotten that I spit on people in the front row when I get excited. So I'm trying to keep back from them so that they don't get the shower they didn't plan for. Even now, I wonder how long before all the pieces of my life get put back together. There are days I wonder if they ever will. How long, Father? How long? How long must we endure the ripple effects of ongoing destruction? How long? I would lie to you if I didn't tell you that I still cry out to the Lord on a regular basis. Yes, I still await some answers. And yes, for the most part, the waiting only serves to fuel my doubt. So if and when I am bitterly honest with myself and with others, I'm forced to admit that how long may only be answered in eternity. And that scares me to death, brother. It scares me to death. Is it okay to doubt? This isn't just an assigned topic to present or research and present at a lectureship or a conference. This is real life. This is my life. And this is my ongoing struggle, the story of wrestling with God. And if you haven't figured it out yet, I am not alone. I am not alone. Some of you wrestle with similar thoughts, or you know people who do. And we need not be naive, nor should we be ignorant. The pews of our churches are filled Sunday after Sunday with folks who question and desperately seek answers from God. One of the greatest mission fields, and I mean this no disrespect for anybody that works in the foreign mission field, one of the greatest mission fields we might encounter is in our churches on Sunday after Sunday after Sunday. Doubt is alive and well, and we have to acknowledge it and face it with courage and conviction. Over the years, I've seen parents, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've had parents come in my office and they're really upset, they're really struggling with some doubt that their child is expressing. I remember doing the same thing when my oldest son reached some different conclusions than I did about doctrines that I thought were cut and dry. I remember really wrestling with why he was expressing this and doubting this and questioning this. There are different kinds of doubt and there are different sources of doubt. We need to learn and embrace and walk with those who express it. Can I say that again? We need to learn to walk and hold on to those who are expressing doubt. They don't need you to stand beside them or in front of them or out from away from them and make out like something's wrong with them for doubting. They need you to take their hand and walk with them through that minefield. Doubt is a natural and normal fact of life. But we made the whole concept into some kind of evil, wicked idea. You know, if you doubt, something's wrong with you. Doubt then becomes a challenge that we avoid. We avoid it like the plague. And consequently, many of us never really deal with our own doubt, much less the doubt of others. We fail to allow those who doubt the honest expression of their pain and confusion and questions. How many of you have heard somebody express doubt and heard somebody else, maybe been the other somebody else that said, "Oh, don't say that. You can't say that. Oh, please don't say that. That's just wrong." No, you're wrong. They need to say it. It's the only way they're ever going to deal with it if they don't express it and have some help working on it. Doubt becomes this twisted and strange, unwelcome relative at the family reunion. Y'all ever been to one of those? Yeah. And somebody shows up and everybody's going, "Who is that? You know, he's from your side of the family." "Oh, no, he's not. He's from yours." You know, who is that fella? Maybe you know that guy. Maybe you are that guy, but it doesn't have to be that way. Doubt can do something wonderful. It can lead us to a better knowledge of and a better relationship with God. Once again, I want you to hear David's doubt. He says, "Oh God, you are my God. Earnestly I search for you. My soul thirsts for you. My whole body longs for you in this parched and weary land where there is no water." And then the answer. "I have seen you in your sanctuary and gazed upon your power and glory. Your unfailing love is better than life itself. How I praise you. I will praise you as long as I live, lifting up my hands to you in prayer. You satisfy me more than the richest feast. I will praise you with songs of joy. I lie awake thinking of you, meditating on you through the night, because you are my helper. I sing for joy in the shadow of your wings. I cling to you. Your strong right hand holds me secure." Is it okay to doubt? Is it okay to doubt? I find it extraordinarily sad that we have to ask that question. I feel sad for those who have wrestled with doubt and been marginalized in the process. Part of our problem with doubt is what I call a dishonest or Pollyanna reading of Scripture. When you pursue Hebrews 11, when you read that great chapter of faith, when you read this chapter, you get an incredible view of folks who did some amazing things with their faith. I read this chapter and I'm thrilled, but I also read this chapter and sometimes come away from it with incredible guilt, a guilt that wasn't really justified. Look at Hebrews 11. I'm going to be reading verses 8 through 12. "It was by faith that Abraham obeyed when God called him to leave home and go to another land that God would give him as his inheritance. He went without knowing where he was going, and even when he reached the land God promised him, he lived there by faith. For he was like a foreigner living in tents, and so did Jacob, Isaac and Jacob, who inherited the same promise. Abraham was confidently looking forward to a city with eternal foundations, a city designed and built by God. It was by faith that Sarah was even able to have a child, though she was barren and was too old. She believed that God would keep his promise, and so a whole nation came from this one man who was as good as dead, a nation with so many people that like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, there is no way to count them. Sounds impressive, doesn't it? What do we call Abraham? The father of faith. When I look at my life, when I look at my flawed responses to God and his word, it's hard to imagine a faith that's that powerful, that trusting, that compliant, and that submissive. But do you really think, when you read this scripture, do you really think that all of that happened, all of that took place without just a smidgen of doubt and fear? Can you really read that and think, knowing human nature like you do, because you are human, do you really think that there weren't any questions and uncertainty in the father of faith's mind? Genesis chapter 15. Sometime later, the Lord spoke to Abraham in a vision and said to him, "Do not be afraid, Abram, for I will protect you and your reward will be great." But Abram replied, "O sovereign Lord, what good are all your blessings when I don't even have a son? Since you've given me no children, Eliezer of Damascus, a servant in my household, will inherit all my wealth. You have given me no descendants of my own, so one of my servants will be my heir." Then the Lord said to him, "No, your servant will not be your heir, for you will have a son of your own who will be your heir." Then the Lord took Abraham outside and said to him, "Look up into the sky and count the stars if you can. That's how many descendants you will have." And Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. Then the Lord told him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land as your possession." It's a great passage, isn't it? If you stop right there and don't read the next verse, you're missing the most important part of all. But Abram replied, "O sovereign Lord, how can I be really sure that I'm going to actually possess it?" In the same conversation with God, not one separated by 10 or 15 years and a lot of life learning and experience, but in the same conversation with God, Abraham believes and doubts. You remember a similar New Testament story? Mark chapter 9. You'll be familiar with it. If you don't know where I'm going, you will. When they returned to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd surrounding them, and some teachers of religious law were arguing with them. When the crowd saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with awe, and they ran to greet him. "What is all this arguing about?" Jesus asked. One of the men in the crowd spoke up and said, "Teacher, I brought my son so you could heal him. He is possessed by an evil spirit that won't let him talk. And whenever this spirit seizes him, it throws him violently to the ground. Then he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast out the evil spirit, but they couldn't do it." Jesus said to them, "You faithless people, how long must I be with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring this boy to me." So they brought the boy, but when the evil spirit saw Jesus, it threw the child into a violent convulsion, and he fell to the ground, writhing and foaming at the mouth. "How long has this been happening?" Jesus asked the boy's father. He replied, "Since he was a little boy. The spirit often throws him into the fire or into water trying to kill him. Have mercy on us and help us if you can." "What do you mean, if I can?" Jesus asked. Anybody here watch NCIS? Used to be my favorite show. And I love the Gibbs slap, the pop in the back of the head. In my mind, Jesus pulls a gib slaps and pops the guy in the back of the head and says, "What do you mean, if I can?" Jesus asked, "Anything is possible if a person believes." The father instantly cried out, and you know these words, don't you? "I do believe, but help me overcome my unbelief." When I go back to Hebrews chapter 11 and again read of those who are cut in half, when I read about those who were flogged and imprisoned, those who were tortured or stoned, those who were killed by the sword, do you really think for a single moment that they suffered those things without ever having any questions or any doubt? Do you really think that they went to their death, they went to torture, and they never cried out to Lord, "Why? Why don't you stop this? Why don't you make this go away? Why don't you smite these people? Why don't you bring fire down from the sky? You really think they did these things and went through this and never experienced a question? Well, let me ask you this question. Would you? Would you? Would you go to your death in an agony greater than anything you could even imagine and not have a question or two for the supreme being of the universe? To see this great chapter of faith while failing to recognize the human nature of each individual found there is setting us up for failure. It's setting us up for failure. If it's not okay to doubt, then some of us, if not all of us, we've got some major struggles and trouble ahead. Is it okay to doubt? What do you think? Is it okay to doubt? Before you answer, I want you to look at a couple more biblical examples. How about the story of Isaac's sacrifice? Can you imagine what it must have been like living with Abraham, the father of faith? I mean, he was worse than any preacher and preacher's son could think of, okay? Living with the father of faith. Living with the father of faith. I can hear him now. You know, son, back in my day when God spoke, we listened. He said go, and by golly, we went. He said leave, and we left. He said, you're going to have a son who will be the child of promise, and a whole nation will come from you. That's you, boy. That's you. Just a few minutes, we're going to load up that donkey there and head up that mountain to offer a sacrifice. And I don't want you to worry one little bit. You carry the firewood and God will provide the sacrifice. I'm going to show my age. My parents are here today and they don't want to acknowledge that I'm 52, but they're old too. They're much older because I'm 52. But do you remember the old sitcom, Different Strokes? Gary Coleman had a signature line he would use on his brother. You remember what that was? What you talking about, Willis? In my imagination, as crazy as it is, I hear Isaac saying something similar to his father about the time he realizes that he's the sacrifice. What you talking about, Dad? What's going on here? How old was Isaac when this episode occurred? There's a lot of disagreement. There's vast disagreement. Some say he was between 18 and 20 years old. That's the lowest age that scholars give us. Between 18 and 20 years old. Anybody here have a teenager? There are three at my house right now. And they argue and question everything. Okay? Some say between 18 and 20. Others have him around 33 years old. The Jewish historian Josephus says he was 25 years old, and there is a whole school of Jewish thought that says he was around 37 years old when this episode took place. They're all over the map, and they all disagree about the age, but there is one thing they all agree on. One thing they all agree on. Isaac was no small boy when this incident occurred. So when you read this story, I want you to read it, try to imagine it, try to comprehend it from Isaac's perspective. Can you imagine that if something like this had happened to you, can you imagine that a story like this with your father? With your father? Can you imagine that a story like this would have stunted your relationship with your father? My dad made us cut wood down in the bottom of a hill and drag it back up. That stunted my relationship. You know? Dad, can't we cut a tree down on level ground where we can just haul it to the... Oh, no, it's got to be at the bottom of the hill, so you got to lug it up, you know? That stunted my relationship with him. But can you imagine this being your father and he's going to sacrifice you because God said so, you don't get a say. You know, you don't get to take a rain check. You don't get to say, you know, Dad, I'm on vacation this week. We'll talk about it later. You don't get a say. How do you have a good relationship with your father going forward from that point on when you were the object lesson in testing his faith? How do you relate to God when he was the one that wanted your dad to murder you, to lay you out and sacrifice you on a fire? Now, from our vantage point, from history, looking back, we can surmise that God would have never allowed such a thing to happen in the first place. But how did he know? How could Isaac have known? His dad, his father, his first best friend, if you will, was willing to take that chance. Would you blame Isaac? Would you blame Isaac or fault him if he spent the rest of his life licking his wounds from such an ordeal? Or would you expect him, like we often do, would you expect him to move forward as if nothing had ever taken place? Can you imagine? I know I'm asking you to do a lot of imagination, but can you imagine that when it came to all things God related, Isaac might very well have wrestled with doubt for the very rest of his life? Is it okay to doubt? I hope I'm building my case that doubt is a normal reaction to the events of life. So far, the doubt examples we've looked at stem from being asked to do something or outside our comfort zones, times when we are asked to just trust and obey. But doubt also comes as a result of unmet expectations. I suspect we've all lived long enough to know what it's like when people don't do what we think they should, right? If you're a parent, you know exactly what I'm talking about. When those we fail to love act in ways we expect, Mom and Dad, I'm sorry, my brother and sisters did you that way. The resultant lack of faith and trust and growing doubt can change those relationships forever. So what happens when it's God who doesn't meet our expectations? What then? How do we react? In my life, when I reached the conclusion that God had failed to keep my family safe when He could have, my faith and trust turned to doubt. My difficulty born out of abuse, rape, and murder has proven to be the challenge, the struggle, and the fight of my life. And I'm not alone. I am not alone. Why is this happening to me? Why or what did I do wrong? Am I being punished for something that I didn't do right or didn't do at all? Where are you, God? Are you really there, God? Why are you ignoring me, God? Can't you see how much this hurts? Lord, this hurts. Are you the one? Does that sound familiar? It should. Those are the words of John the Baptist, the man who baptized Jesus, the man who saw the Spirit of God descend, the man who heard the voice and the proclamation of God, "You are my Son, whom I love, with you I am well pleased." John's ministry was an amazing thing. He did the work of God, the forerunner of the Messiah, the one who paved the road Jesus would follow. But then came the unexpected, the unplanned for. John was arrested, placed in prison because of the righteousness he preached. Eventually, he was beheaded. God never released him. Jesus never came for him. And in the agony of wondering and waiting, he sent the message to Jesus. Are you the one? Are you the one who is to come? Or should we expect someone else? I don't know about you, but I'm starting to read the Bible from a whole different perspective. I'm beginning to look at Bible characters and their lives and seeing them in an entirely different light. Connecting to the pain, seeing Bible characters as real people with the whole range of emotions, fears, worries, and doubts, all that discovery has been absolutely liberating for me. Hebrews 11 is a chapter of faith stories. But those stories come from people who are normal, who had doubts, who had fears, who had worries. And I have to tell you, at this stage of my life, I rejoice in knowing that I am not alone. I'm not going to go any further. It's time. I'm going to finish up this lesson at 3 o'clock. And if you have any questions, I welcome them. If you don't want to hear the brutal truth, don't ask them, because I will tell you exactly where I am and where I've been. My deceased wife's father is here today. I'm so thankful to get to see him. And one of us is going to have to leave the room before the other one starts blubbering completely. But I thank you for being here. I'm going to talk about it in another lesson a little bit. You may or may not be here, but the murders of Karen and Cole weren't the first foray into doubt that I had. My new friend Tim Piles is here. He will know exactly what I'm talking about. Cole was handicapped, was never like other kids. And I struggled with that off and on over the years, asking God, you do all these things, why can't you just fix him now? It gives me a measure of joy and a measure of hurt at the same time to say, he did fix him. And I cannot wait to see what that looks like one day. Thank you.